Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
Today? Well, we will when you get an idea what we're up to here on a Saturday high noon in the nod-off corner of northeast Kansas, the autonomous region called North Jefferson County, Kansas. Definitely autonomous. Free-thinking, free-spirited, and practically lawless. It will be Mother's Day. I was reminded today that Mother's Day is actually tomorrow. I guess it's on a Sunday. I did not know that. It's all weekend. Let's dedicate some music to who? All of our mothers. And I'll tell you some stories about past Mother's Day in my old hometown of Leroy, Kansas. And I think you might find it interesting what's coming at the bottom of the hour. We're going to have Brandi Fisher with the Mainstream Coalition. She's going to be on at the bottom of the hour. We won't have her very long, but we'll have her on. She's going to talk about, well, what is the Mainstream Coalition? And what did she see when she was at the state house in Topeka over this legislative session while it was going on? And in the meantime, if you have time, go to the mainstreamcoalition.org website. Very, very, very informative. And I think you'll enjoy what you're about to hear because it's good. It really is. Here's some music.
Honeybee, something's wrong with you, I feel. It's getting hotter.
Well, that sounds like something a mother would say. But that's from the Boardwalk Empire, Volume 1. And I hope you enjoy it. Yes, the mothers, they happen to, you know, wouldn't you, you know, if you thought about it, it's only been about 3,000 years, wouldn't it be better to have you ever thought maybe letting the mothers decide when to wage war? It's called a matriarchy, you know. Mothers can't live with them, can't live without them. Mothers. Now, there was a time back, oh, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, oh my God, what is it, 40, perhaps 45 years ago, they would force us to go down to the church, the Methodist church in Leroy, and sing, and I had to, we always sang this song about mother, it was, spelling out the word, you know. M is for the million things you've done for me. O is how old you're getting now. T is for the, I forgot it all. But you put it all together and it spells mother. I used to wonder why we sang that. I won't bore you too much, but I will tell you this. At that young age of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I never figured out why they wore different color corsages, all the women. Yeah. Well, it was about whether they were alive or dead, their mothers. So if you're lucky enough to know your mother and know where she's at, and she's alive, maybe get her a flower or just call. Spend some time with her on the phone. Listen to the problems. Yes, listen to the problems. Then tell her what you think. You know, don't go Freudian on him. Tell her, hey, you know, the world would probably be a better place if women ran the damn thing. There's no question about that in my mind, I think. Why are we even talking about the glass ceiling nowadays? You think about slavery and pyramids and pharaohs and all that stuff. Hierarchical societies, you know. Layer after layer of the wedding cake. Oh, wait a minute. I wonder why they called that a wedding cake. Oh, my goodness. Of course, we'd have to go back to some sort of, I don't know, Native American society, or I guess some of the Native American clans or nations had matriarchal systems. Mother's Day. It wouldn't be as much war, famine, unequal distribution of wealth. No, there wouldn't be. At least it would be more contested. What is that about the hell, the scorn of a woman? How about the scorn of a mother? Oh! Get into some politics here at the end of the, or excuse me, at the bottom of the hour with Brandy Fisher, as I said earlier, with the Mainstream Coalition. But there's a lot of mothers in the Mainstream Coalition. Comes out of Kansas. We'll hear about the history of it a little bit and what they did, what they've done, and what she saw, most importantly, what she saw at the Topeka State House. And in the second hour, I'll have announcements of things going on in the coming week. Good things. Fun things. Things that can put a zing in your voice and a bounce in your walk and make you want to just smile at those people that consider you an enemy.
Jackie Horner, 'tis their wedding day. See the bride walk down the aisle, how her cheeks do flush. If you knew her like I do, you'd say she ought to blush. See the bride hide her eyes, she knows everybody's wise. No wonder she's a blushing bride. Every boy in every pew knows how she can bill and coo. No wonder she's a blushing bride. The preacher reads the service, while the organ plays. He gets kind of nervous, he knew her in his younger days. Seven daddies, so they say, have come to give this bride away. No wonder she's a blushing bride. Years ago, and you should know the things I know. No wonder she's a blushing bride. She acts scared, watch her shake. She knows she's got a lucky break. No wonder she's a blushing bride. I hear someone laughing. Well, it's no time for that. Maybe that's what you think, but you don't know what they're laughing at. There's her former husband there. There's two others over there. No wonder she's a blushing bride. Now you can see, if you search, all her boyfriends in the church. No wonder she's a blushing bride. There is Tom and Dick and Bill. She gave all of them a thrill. No wonder she's a blushing bride. There is Jimmy Johnson, one of those she knew. He could give the bridegroom some inside information too. She knows what he knows right well. She only hopes that he won't tell. No wonder she's a blushing bride.
Thank you. I'm falling, falling for nobody else but you. You caught my eye, and I've got a feeling I'm falling. Show me the ring and I'll jump right through. I used to travel single, oh, we chance to mingle, oh, now I'm a tingle over you. Hey, Mr. Parker, stand by, for I've got a feeling I'm falling, falling for nobody else but you.
Thank you.
Good news, listeners. Good news. We'll have Brandy Fisher with the Mainstream Coalition on the phone in another couple songs. We could give her a few minutes to settle down, and we'll have a little chat with her about the Mainstream Coalition. And again, check your website, mainstreamcoalition.org. We'll be back in about 4 or 5 minutes. Thank you for listening to Radio Free Kansas. Come from Gray Mercy Records, graymercyrecords.com, and that's Volume 1, The Roaring Twenties, and you can find them in their catalog. We'll be back after this with Brandy Fisher of the Mainstream Coalition. Again, check your web browser and check out mainstreamcoalition.org, fascinating organization in Kansas City. It's a wonderful organization, really. I've been following it for years. We'll have Miss Fisher on in just a little bit.
Let a lady confess I want to confess. If it's naughty to them, the men sleep each morning after 10, then the answer is yes, I want to confess. This thing of being a good little goody is all very well. And it's naughty to ask for more. Let a lady confess I want to be fair. Yes, I want to be best. And if it's naughty to them from then, sleep each morning, laugh to ten, then the answer is yes, I want to be best. Nobody cares just how blue and how lonesome I am. If I have troubles and laugh, why they don't give a damn. So fret it, if it's small to let someone pay, just a little kiss by mistake. Let a lady confess I want to be best.
Volume 1 of the Naughty 20s, Gray Mercy Records, I Want to Be Bad. I wonder, we have Brandy Fisher on the phone. Miss Fisher, welcome to Radio Free Kansas. Thank you for giving us your time on this busy Saturday.
Hey, thanks, Mike, for having me.
Hey, is your mother alive, and are you a mother?
I'm actually in Wichita this weekend with my mother for Mother's Day. So, and I'm
That's
a mom.
Right. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Talking,
in fact, I'm sitting in the parking lot outside Cowtown. So.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. They're in Cowtown while I'm here with you. So looking. This is exciting. It's nice.
I won't take up much of your time. I know it's a busy mm-hmm. time. I made my obligatory phone call to my mother early before the show, and we had so much to catch up on. I had to get her off the phone so I could start the show. And my dearly beloved, she who must be obeyed, is taking off to see her mother. Mother's Days are very special to us because I'm of the opinion that we might be better off with a matriarchy after a thousand years of failed experiments in hierarchical male-dominated politics. But enough of that. Let's just talk about your group and what you've been doing. Speaking of a patriarchy, you've been at the Topeka State House. What are you doing exactly? Tell us what you've been doing.
Gosh, well,
Take
let me just
time.
Give you your listeners just a quick pitch about Mainstream.
Sure.
Mainstream was founded just over 20 years ago. Founder was a man named Dr. Bob Menealy. He was the founder of Village Presbyterian Church. And then started Mainstream along with some others, primarily a Democratic legislator, Carol Sader, and a Republican legislator, Nancy Brown. They were both in the House in the early 90s. And then some other community activists, members from the Jewish community, from Village Church community, that were really concerned about what was beginning to feel like this sort of, hostile feelings towards separation of church and state. And by a group
Brandy, was that what I did not know that I did not realize that was the original motivation. I know that, and I know that in the 20s, it was 20 years ago. That would have been in the 90s, correct? And Dr. Menealy
right.
is a grand gentleman. And is he still alive for our older listeners?
He is still alive and politically engaged. And yeah, no, he's really is something special. And right, so separation of church and state, at that time, those that were sort of anti-separation of church and state was very covert. So you'd see these candidates that seemed very moderate, and mm-hmm. then they'd get to Topeka, and then you'd find that they had this sort of religious ideology that was motivating them. And I don't know if you remember in Wichita that summer of 93 we got a lot of national attention. It was the Summer of Mercy, and Randall Terry mm-hmm. from Operation and Rescue was in Wichita, and it became just this, was sort of the epicenter of the abortion movement here. And that
mm-hmm,
was
mm-hmm.
tied in. So over time, Mainstream, it started with separation of church and state, which became then really a strong focus on public schools, really in response to those that were pushing vouchers and as a way of diverting public funds, public taxpayers into religious schools. So we got involved there. And in recent years have really, more Mainstream is Republicans, Democrats, Independents that are really concerned about having a strong, moderate, centrist voice in Kansas. Kansas has this rich centrist, even some would say progressive history. You wouldn't
mm-hmm.
know that now or think that. Excuse me. So we we really now are trying to stand to be sort of the counter voice to political extremism. So even beyond separation of church and state, really, you know, still believing that there is a role for government and for democratic process and for having a transparency in government. And so, you know, this session, gosh, this really was a year that really focused on public education. And
excuse me, Brandy, can I say something just for real quick?
Yeah, please.
As an listeners, you got to realize when Ms. Fisher is talking about Kansas as a progressive state, you got to realize the first mayor elected in the United States was a woman, and in Kansas. And the largest in the history of the United States, the largest socialist newspaper, circulated over 1 million a week readers, was published out of Little Girard, Kansas, right after the turn of the century up to World War One. It was called The Appeal to Reason. So Kansas, and there was a lot of Republicans who were very progressive. You got to remember this was the state was founded as a free men, freed men against slavery, free land. And it's the home where John Brown made his first stand against slavery. Kansas has a long history of even progressive conservatism. And after all, listeners, conservative means conservation. And take it or leave it, listeners, this is an incredible development. This mainstream coalition, I've watched it over the years. And, I come from the left persuasion, but it was my first alarm bell when I saw the formation of the mainstream coalition years ago. I realized our state was in trouble. I realized, but I did not know how far it would go, as we are witnessing now with Governor Sam Brownback and these severely people. Even conservatives do not even call them conservatives in the majority in the state legislature. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to put a historical context on the phenomena of the mainstream coalition, in my opinion. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's, gosh, you know, 20 years ago when we first started, it was really trying to out these candidates that were covertly extreme. And now that part of our organization isn't relevant. Now the most extreme candidates are openly extreme, don't represent traditional Kansas values, and they're being elected. So, we're certainly sending people to Topeka that don't represent the majority of Kansas values or interests. And when I say that, I'm talking, I guess, left all the way to fairly traditional conservative. And I think we decided to cast a larger net and a larger umbrella as a political home for those that may be to the left or to the right, but believe, as I said, I mean, believe in the role of government, believe in public education as, you know, fundamental to our democracy, and believe in access to voting. And what we're seeing now is, you know, really an attack not on just on public schools, but on separation of powers. I mean, having an independent justice system and having a, you know, trying to limit people's ability to vote and their access to vote. And, you know, we saw that a couple of years ago with the voter ID laws. This is the start, then requiring a proof of citizenship. Of course, you know, many people don't realize that those laws, they're not, you know, it's a problem. It's a problem that, you know, is self-created, right? We didn't have a voter fraud problem. Our Secretary of State, Secretary Kobach, would agree there was no voter fraud problem, and yet we're spending millions to now require, citizenship and proof of citizenship. A lot of people don't realize how challenging it is for women to vote, because if you change your name when you marry and your name doesn't match your birth certificate, there's a whole other step in the process. So,
right, and if you're a woman who married a Kansan male, you know, and you're here. You have to go back to your original state to get your birth certificate, which is an additional expense and time necessary in order to register to vote. And it's that should throw that on the Mother's Day heap of abuse that's going on with women in the state of Kansas.
And we could just talk about women's issue this weekend, Mike, right? Because it's going on for women. I mean, it's People don't think about that.
Well,
I mean,
hey,
20%
hey, Brandy,
seniors.
Brandy, did you actually hear? You were at the State House, am I correct or not? Throughout
yeah.
this legislation,
I'm in and out of the State House. Yeah, so tell me.
Did you actually hear these people, these men, mainly men, and Susan Wagle, who has yet to wiggle, who is the head of the state Senate, Ms. Fisher? Did you actually hear them call these associations, the National Education Association, were they actually calling them thugs, union thugs? And I saw on your website, I'm just bubbly right now because I'm so excited to talk to you. I looked at your website this morning before I called Mother, and oh my goodness, these people are, you know, if this is the mainstream, you know, I mean, this is great. You know, this is good stuff because you have a picture there, courtesy of Andy Marshall, a reporter at the Topeka Capital Journal, that shows this.
Yeah.
I think his name is Mike Todd or something like that. Go there to the website, mainstreamcoalition.org, and, you know, dig around in there, and you'll see this color picture of this guy wearing a T-shirt. And it says, I torch Kansas. Listeners, are you listening? Now, I come from the left, but I'm sort of radical, but I would never advocate burning down our beloved state of Kansas. But that's what that shirt basically says. And who is that guy? Who is that guy, and what kind of group would do that?
Right. So,
you know?
Americans for Prosperity had their folks out in full force during the veto session, the last 3 days wrapping up the session, in these green T-shirts, and one of the Andy Marceau, Kansas journalists, took a picture. We pulled that picture off of his Twitter feed, but I torch Kansas, and that's essentially, I mean, it's this belief that, you know, government needs to be made absolutely as small as possible. We're all for efficient government, fiscal responsibility, but and that they're not going to end until, I mean, it's this race to the bottom. No income tax, and you know, and we're already seeing what that's done with our current budget. And, so wearing I Torch Kansas shirts.
That's a real fact. I mean, there's no refuting that they've actually went to the trouble of printing up T-shirts bragging. They're bragging about the destruction of our state, listeners, the destruction of our state, the public education. And we only have 10-11 minutes with Ms. Fisher right now, but I want to let you could you talk to us a little bit on what they've done to these teachers, calling them union thugs, cutting off their due process rights. A lot of people don't know what that means. They shrouded it and called tenure here. These attacks on teachers, on women, it's just outrageous what they're doing, Ms. Fisher. And you got 10 minutes. Feel free. I'll try not to interrupt you, but I'm just so outraged.
Oh, I love it.
When I saw that photograph of that guy wearing that T-shirt about bragging about burning up the state of Kansas, that just torqued me to no end this morning. I'm sorry, but that really bothered me. Go ahead.
Was it the Eagle, or could have been Topeka Capital, that reported that Americans for Prosperity, this I Torch Kansas group and the Koch brothers, that they spent over $500,000 during that 3-day session to get the renewable portfolio standards, the RPS standards, to get those, you know, to end those. And, I mean, that's actually a testament both to Kansas activism and the fact that from these, you know, special interest groups that Kansas still has, I mean, they're still moderate at its core. Because after six votes, they still, you know, we still kept those standards in place. And I don't know if you saw the attack ads, Mike, but they were these commercials that were showing, you know, seniors and how their utility bills were going up. And the reality is, and per the news reporting, that the utility bills are going up, but that the increase based on these, you know, environmental standards and the wind energy that we're doing may account for up to possibly 1% of any increase they're seeing in their utility bills.
1%. That's all.
1%.
And the rest of it, I'm sure it's to pay for the Westar Board of Executives or whatever. You know what I mean? These big shots on the top, you know what I mean? Excuse me.
Yeah. So, you know, the environment, I mean, many mainstreamers are strong environmentalists, but that's not one of our core issues. But a core issue is good government, and this isn't good government, you know, and that's why it's just like what we're seeing in education, what we're seeing in with the judicial issues. You know, the governor and the leadership and the Senate and House didn't like that the courts weren't, you know, right in line with them. Well, then it's like, all right, how do we limit the power and effectiveness of our courts? You know, how do we punish them? And I think that's a real concern, is that any voice that is in opposition to them is really being silenced. And it's the same with the NEA. The NEA is one of the strongest voices for moderation and, of course, for public schools, and the attacks on teachers that we've seen in the last 2 years have been just really disheartening. My mom's an educator, so since we're thinking about our mothers this weekend, seeing what they've done with the due process, a lot of people think that it's about tenure. The reality is it's not teacher tenure. What it is due process allows for educators that, you know, not to be fired without any process, so that there's, you know, a board that they can challenge a firing. It's teachers have to be there 3 years before they're eligible for due process. I'm not an expert on due process, but that's my understanding. And the reason it was started in Kansas is because a teacher wouldn't, those instances where teachers wouldn't raise a grade so that a student could play sports. And I believe that there was fired, and I don't know if you've seen the video. She's just spoke at a forum here in Derby talking about that, about being, you know, 20 years ago being fired because she wouldn't change a student's grade so that he could play. And so, you know, in my town and in my mission,
Didn't she have to fight that all the way to the Supreme Court?
Right.
And it was way back and a long time ago, and it was really sort of a landmark ruling, and it really sort of enshrined I call it a grievance procedure, and you just can't throw people, especially our public educators, out on the streets without some sort of process where, especially teachers who've made it through 3 years of these horribly low wages that we pay our K-12 teachers in the state. I really don't see any K-12 teachers on the board of directors or anything. And I just, every angle. And the mainstream coalition is tried and true. They've been out there a long time. Really, listeners, they've been out there a long time.
You know, it's love to have your membership involved. You can go to our website and just put your email in and get we publish a newsletter every other week during the legislative session, which is now over, but we'll do through the end of May, a legislative update. We've done that every other week. All of them are on our website. You can go back and read them. And then in the off weeks, we try to do a blog post. This last week, we did a three-part blog series on ALEC, on the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a national group that is feeding these bills that are already written. They call them, you know, and we'll say in quotes, model legislation, this boilerplate legislation that these legislators can put forward that to privatize and to push small government. And many times, you know, you'll hear the legislators say when questioned, mainstream testified 10 times this session, and we'd be questioned. We'd ask these questions, and sometimes hear the host legislator, the sponsor legislator say, well, I haven't read the full bill. He didn't read the full bill because he was given it to him by Alex. And I really encourage people to read more about that. I think a couple of years ago, they were so under the radar, most people hadn't heard of them. I think that's changing. Their national conference was just in Kansas City last weekend. We did a three-part series showing who in the Kansas legislature is a member of ALEC. To our Senate President, Susan Weigel, and our Speaker of the House, Ray Merrick, are two of the 16-member national governing board of ALEC. So it's, it sounds like, you know, we've bought into some conspiracy theory. So I don't know who's conspiracy.
No, it doesn't.
Ours
no, it
are
doesn't
there.
Make,
but, I mean,
no.
It really, if you connect the dots, each of these bills seems harmful, but maybe, you know, it's not the end of the world. But when you look at the continued attacks on public schools, you look at the attacks on women that continued to limit our ability to vote, it really does paint a picture of, you know, a kind of society that's governed by a very, very small a group of special interest, and they're not interests that represent mainstream Kansans.
And this is what you this is why we talk about the mainstream coalition has talked about the extremism. The word extremism seems to be the one I see them in the blog and in the webpage. And I the thought of using the force of arms to change the government. Well, these people didn't do that. They did it much diabolical. More diabolical, and it is a conspiracy. And I'll tell you something, Ms. Fisher. 3-4 years ago, I found out I got me an Alec tie clasp. They actually have little secret things they can wear on their ties, and they don't really talk about it back then. Now they have to, but they actually had jewelry. Are you hearing this, listeners?
I heard that.
They actually had jewelry that they would wear that would have this this little signal among the members, and I don't think a lot of listeners realize that the quadzillion billionaire Koch brothers out of Koch Industries in Wichita were the prime financiers of that. And correct?
Sorry, drop my phone. That's right. They've been involved for a long time and put a lot of money into Alec, and even more. I don't know the amount. Alec is everything's very secret. Right, so they're meeting their secret and how much money they're actually putting in, but that they put money there into Americans for Prosperity, into the Kansas Policy Institute. They're personally financing this move to this extremist agenda. We say extremist a lot of me because, and I loved it what you said earlier about this not being even anti-conservative. I was at a forum. And a week ago, a moderate Republican legislator said, look, I think I'm conservative in that what we've done in Kansas with this, with these tax cuts, that hasn't been conservative. And a conservative wouldn't do something like that. She said, and so she was really trying to make the case that, they're really the anti-conservative. And, but it's certainly this Tea Party, small government at all, at any expense. And my biggest concern is, those towns in western Kansas that are really going to suffer because, the schools and the medical facilities. And I had a conversation with a doctor last week, and he said that our current plans not expanding, not doing the Medicaid expansion, going to CanCare could make it so that many towns don't have access to a doctor. They'll just, maybe have a nurse practitioner that will be able to serve.
Exactly. That's what's going on out here in Jefferson County between even as close as Topeka and Kansas City. We're right in the middle and north of Lawrence, about 40 miles north of Lawrence. So I'm watching it in our county newspapers week by week, how they're bringing in, the doctors are getting older. They want to retire. Young doctors don't want to move out here because there's no real economic incentive. Brownback has refused to take federal funding for Medicaid. And whether you like it or not, white people out here in the rural areas, most of you are using Medicaid and Medicare. And that's the federal funding. And Governor Brownback has refused it. The mainstream coalition shines because it is not a partisan organization. And when you talk about conservatism, you've got to think about conserving your public schools. You don't want people living in your children going to one-room school shacks on dirt floors learning how to count or read. There's a lot more to education now than just learning than basic literacy and mathematics. And conservatism means conserving your land and conserving the good things that we've already accumulated. And part of that is, listeners, not bringing your religion from the pulpit in a demagogic fashion out into the open air of the state legislature and enforcing that upon down the throats of all the other people who think religion, like sex, should be a private affair. And I want to thank you. You have if you want to take 30 seconds, Ms. Fisher from the Mainstream Coalition, please, your final statement, and thank you for coming on.
Oh, gosh. I mean, it was so much fun. Thanks for having me on. I'd love to come back. And, I just encourage you, I'd love for you to go to our website, get the information. We're active on social media, so Facebook, Mainstream Coalition, and I think that there's nothing more important right now than staying informed and then voting in November, but also voting in August. The August primaries are critical, and, you know, vote, and as we say, Mainstream, do more than vote. Get in contact with a good candidate who's running. Run yourself, and Kansas is, that, you know,
Brandy, there's something coming up on your calendar. What is it, May 27th, May 29th? What's going on?
Oh, gosh, I love it. So we're having a forum on May 29th, and we'll talk about how this session played out and what it means going forward, how it'll affect us. And it's in Prairie Village Colonial Church. I love what you said about keeping religion separate, and something I think is cool about Mainstream is we have a lot of ministers. We have a rabbi that was one of our founders.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, this isn't about anti-religion. In fact, many people in Mainstream are faith leaders, but it's about respecting the role of religion and keeping it independent from the role of government.
Yeah,
so
where is it?
Separating faith out of religion, it's separating imposing religious identity.
What time is it? Can you do you offhand? I'll look it up on your website.
The information's on our website. It's 7 o'clock. For those of you that are near the Johnson County area, it's 7 o'clock at Colonial Church in Prairie Village. There's a bar across the street, so we go out afterwards and keep the conversation going. I mean, it's nice to know that you know that there are other like-minded folks. And the truth is there are more of us than of them. But what we're not doing is voting. And maybe your listeners are voting, but then can they get the five people they know in their network, get them to the polls to vote?
That's right. And with that, Brandy Fisher, have a great day with your mother, and give her our best regards from Northeast Kansas, and thank you.
Thanks. This made my day, and thank you for having me.
Let's sow a wild oat, and I'll be back with you later after this.
Lost, but when I get started, I work fast. Let's sow a wild oat. Let's sow a wild oat. We'll go strolling far away and find some place where we can play. Have our fun and let it lay. Let's sow a wild oat. Let's sow a wild oat. Let's sow a wild oat. Brother, this and sister, that is very fine. But when it comes to love, I want to keep in mind. Let's sow a wild oat. Let's sow a wild oat. We'll step out, just you and me. We'll go someplace where we can see the night boat leave for Tennessee. Let's sow a wild oat. Shoot, dude, more reggae ballon. Shoot, dude, garibidon. Ziggy-dick, no low, ribby-dog, walk at home. Use my god, riggy that stack. Eat the rock of me, I should die. Eat the goody, bop, me, the dog, and gone. Shoot the knock around, he didn't, so did I. He knock around, but he go, so go, that's a dindy bone. He's looking, but he got to get the, so did he. Let's all wallow.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read and recorded by William Kuhn, March 2006. A Psychological Shipwreck by Ambrose Bierce. In the summer of 1874, I was in Liverpool, whither I had gone on business for the mercantile house of Bronson and Jarrett, New York. I am William Jarrett. My partner was Zenas Bronson. The firm failed last year, and, unable to endure the fall from affluence to poverty, he died. Having finished my business, and feeling the lassitude and exhaustion incident to its dispatch, I felt that a protracted sea voyage would be both agreeable and beneficial. So instead of embarking for my return on one of the many fine passenger steamers, I booked for New York on the sailing vessel Morrow, upon which I had shipped a large and valuable invoice of the goods I had bought. The Morrow was an English ship with, of course, but little accommodation for passengers, of whom there were only myself, a young woman, and her servant, who was a middle-aged negress. I thought it singular that a traveling English girl should be so attended, but she afterward explained to me that the woman had been left with her family by a man and his wife from South Carolina, both of whom had died on the same day at the house of the young lady's father in Devonshire, a circumstance in itself sufficiently uncommon to remain rather distinctly in my memory, even had it not afterward transpired in conversation with the young lady that the name of the man was William Jarrett, the same as my own. I knew that a branch of my family had settled in South Carolina, but of them and their history I was ignorant. The Morrow sailed from the mouth of the Mersey on the 15th of June, and for several weeks we had fair breezes and unclouded skies. The skipper, an admirable seaman but nothing more, favored us very little of his society, except at his table. And the young woman, Miss Jeanette Harford, and I became very well acquainted. We were, in truth, nearly always together, and being of an introspective turn of mind, I often endeavored to analyze and define the novel feeling with which she inspired me, a secret, subtle, but powerful attraction which constantly impelled me to seek her, but the attempt was hopeless. I could only be sure that at least it was not love. Having assured myself of this, and being certain that she was quite as wholehearted, I ventured one evening, I remember it was on the 3rd of July, as we sat on the deck to ask her, laughingly, if she could assist me to resolve my psychological doubt. For a moment she was silent, with averted face, and I began to fear I had been extremely rude and indelicate. Then she fixed her eyes gravely on my own. In an instant my mind was dominated by as strange a fancy as ever entered human consciousness. It seemed as if she were looking at me, not with, but through those eyes, from an immeasurable distance behind them, and that a number of other persons, men, women, and children, upon whose faces I caught strangely familiar evanescent expressions, clustered about her, struggling with gentle eagerness to look at me through the same orbs. Ship, ocean, sky, all had vanished. I was conscious of nothing but the figures in this extraordinary and fantastic scene. Then all at once darkness fell upon me, and anon from out of it, as to one who grows accustomed by degrees to a dimmer light, my former surroundings of deck and mast and cordage slowly resolved themselves. Miss Harford had closed her eyes and was leaning back in her chair, apparently asleep, the book she had been reading open in her lap. Impelled by surely I cannot say what motive, I glanced at the top of the page. It was a copy of that rare and curious work, Denneker's Meditations, and the lady's index finger rested on this passage. To sundry it is given to be drawn away, and to be apart from the body for a season. For, as concerning rills which would flow across each other, the weaker is borne along by the stronger. So there be certain of kin whose paths intersecting, their souls do bear company, the while their bodies go four appointed ways, unknowing. Miss Harford arose, shuddering. The sun had sunk below the horizon, but it was not cold. There was not a breath of wind, there were no clouds in the sky, yet not a star was visible. A hurried tramping sounded on the deck. The captain, summoned from below, joined the first officer, who stood looking at the barometer. "Good God!" I heard him exclaim. An hour later, the form of Jeanette Harford, invisible in the darkness and spray, was torn from my grasp by the cruel vortex of the sinking ship, and I fainted in the cordage of the floating mast to which I had lashed myself. It was by lamplight that I awoke. I lay in a berth amid the familiar surroundings of the stateroom of a steamer. On a couch opposite sat a man, half undressed for bed, reading a book. I recognized the face of my friend, Gordon Doyle, whom I had met in Liverpool on the day of my embarkation, when he was himself about to sail on the steamer City of Prague, on which he had urged me to accompany him. After some moments, I now spoke his name. He simply said, "Well?" and turned a leaf in his book without removing his eyes from the page. "Doyle," I repeated, "did they save her?" He now deigned to look at me and smiled as if amused. He evidently thought me but half awake. "Her? Whom do you mean?" "Jeanette Harford." His amusement turned to amazement. He stared at me fixedly, saying nothing. "You will tell me after a while," I continued. "I suppose you will tell me after a while." A moment later, I asked, "What ship is this?" Doyle stared again. "The steamer, City of Prague, bound from Liverpool to New York, 3 weeks out with a broken shaft. Principal passenger, Mr. Gordon Doyle. Ditto, lunatic, Mr. William Jarrett. These two distinguished travelers embarked together, but they are about to part, it being the resolute intention of the former to pitch the latter overboard." I sat bolt upright. "Do you mean to say that I have been for 3 weeks a passenger on this steamer?" "Yes, pretty nearly. This is the 3rd of July."
"Have I been ill?"
"Right as a trivet all the time, and punctual at your meals."
"My God, Doyle, there is some mystery here. Do have the goodness to be serious. Was I not rescued from the wreck of the ship Morrow?"
Doyle changed color, and approaching me, laid his finger on my wrist. A moment later, "What do you know of Jeanette Harford?" he asked very calmly.
"First, tell me what you know of her."
Mr. Doyle gazed at me for some moments as if thinking what to do. Then, seating himself again on the couch, said, "Why should I not? I am engaged to marry Jeanette Harford, whom I met a year ago in London. Her family, one of the wealthiest in Devonshire, cut up rough about it, and we eloped. Are eloping, rather, for on the day that you and I walked to the landing stage to go aboard this steamer, she and her faithful servant, a negress, passed us, driving to the ship Morrow. She would not consent to go in the same vessel with me, and it had been deemed best that she take a sailing vessel in order to avoid observation and lessen the risk of detection. I am now alarmed lest this cursed breaking of our machinery may detain us so long that the Morrow will get to New York before us, and the poor girl will not know where to go." I lay still in my berth, so still I hardly breathed. But the subject was evidently not displeasing to Doyle, and after a short pause, he resumed. "By the way, she is only an adopted daughter of the Harfords. Her mother was killed at their place by being thrown from a horse while hunting, and her father, mad with grief, made away with himself the same day. No one ever claimed the child, and after a reasonable time they adopted her. She has grown up in the belief that she is their daughter."
"Doyle, what book are you reading?"
"Oh, it's called Denneker's Meditations. It's a rum lot. Jeanette gave it to me. She happened to have two copies. Want to see it?" He tossed me the volume, which opened as it fell. On one of the exposed pages was a marked passage. "To sundry it is given to be drawn away, and to be apart from the body for a season. For, as concerning rills which would flow across each other, the weaker is borne along by the stronger, so there be certain of kin whose paths intersecting, their souls do bear company, the while their bodies go four appointed ways, unknowing."
She has,
a singular taste in reading," I managed to say, mastering my agitation.
"Yes.
And now perhaps you will have the kindness to explain how you knew her name and that of the ship she sailed in."
"You talked of her in your sleep," I said.
A week later, we were towed into the port of New York. But the Morrow was never heard from. End of A Psychological Shipwreck by Ambrose Bierce.
Got one more. If you haven't checked out LibriVox, you're missing out, really. Free, read by volunteers, great audio books. Something to check out. I'm going to finish with The Incident, also by Ambrose Bierce. He's not really recognized much in American literature, except for a few short stories. Very interesting guy. We'll finish up with Incident at Owl Creek Bridge. It runs about 22 minutes, and then I'll have some program schedule announcements. Thank you for listening.
Is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Matthew Fulton. An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce. This file contains the entire story. Part 1. A man stood upon a railroad bridge in northern Alabama, looking down into the swift water 20 feet below. The man's hands were behind his back, the wrists bound with a cord. A rope closely encircled his neck. It was attached to a stout cross timber above his head, and the slack fell to the level of his knees. Some loose boards, laid upon the ties, supporting the rails of the railway, supplied a footing for him and his executioners, two private soldiers of the Federal Army, directed by a sergeant, who in civil life may have been a deputy sheriff. At a short remove upon the same temporary platform was an officer in the uniform of his rank, armed. He was a captain. A sentinel at each end of the bridge stood with his rifle in the position known as support, that is to say, vertical in front of the left shoulder, the hammer resting on the forearm, thrown straight across the chest, a formal and unnatural position, enforcing an erect carriage of the body. It did not appear to be the duty of these two men to know what was occurring at the center of the bridge. They merely blockaded the two ends of the foot planking that traversed it. Beyond one of the sentinels, nobody was in sight. The railroad ran straight away into a forest for 100 yards, then, curving, was lost to view. Doubtless there was an outpost further along. The other bank of the stream was open ground, a gentle slope topped with a stockade of vertical tree trunks, loophole for rifles, with a single embrasure through which protruded the muzzle of a brass cannon commanding the bridge. Midway up the slope, between the bridge and the fort, were the spectators, a single company of infantry in line, at parade rest, the butts of their rifles on the ground, the barrels inclining slightly backward against the right shoulder, the hands crossed upon the stock. A lieutenant stood at the right of the line, the point of his sword upon the ground, his left hand resting upon his right. Excepting the group of four at the center of the bridge, not a man moved. The company faced the bridge, staring stonily, motionless. The sentinels, facing the banks of the streams, might have been statues to adorn the bridge. The captain stood with folded arms, silent, observing the work of his subordinates, but making no sign. Death is a dignitary who, when he comes announced, is to be received with formal manifestation of respect, even by those most familiar with him. In the code of military etiquette, silence and fixity are forms of deference. The man who was engaged in being hanged was apparently about 35 years of age. He was a civilian, if one might judge from his habit, which was that of a planter. His features were good, a straight nose, firm mouth, broad forehead, from which his long dark hair was combed straight back, falling behind his ears to the collar of his well-fitting frock coat. He wore a mustache and pointed beard, but no whiskers. His eyes were large and dark gray, and had a kindly expression which one would have hardly expected in one whose neck was in the hemp. Evidently, this was no vulgar assassin. The liberal military code makes provisions for the hanging of many kinds of persons, and gentlemen are not excluded. The preparations being complete, the two private soldiers stepped aside, and each drew away the plank upon which he had been standing. The sergeant turned to the captain, saluted, and placed himself immediately behind that officer, who in turn moved apart one pace. These movements left the condemned man and the sergeant standing on the two ends of the same plank, which spanned three of the cross ties of the bridge. The end upon which the civilian stood almost, but not quite, reached a fourth. This plank had been held in place by the weight of the captain. It was now held by that of the sergeant. At a signal from the former, the latter would step aside, the plank would tilt, and the condemned man go down between two ties. The arrangement commended itself to his judgment as simple and effective. His face had not been covered, nor his eyes bandaged. He looked a moment at his unsteadfast footing, then let his gaze wander to the swirling water of the stream, racing madly beneath his feet. A piece of dangling driftwood caught his attention, and his eyes followed it down the current. How slowly it appeared to move! What a sluggish stream! He closed his eyes in order to fix his last thoughts upon his wife and children. The water touched to gold by the early sun, the brooding mists under the banks at some distance down the stream, the fort, the soldiers, the piece of drift, all had distracted him. And now he became conscious of a new disturbance, striking through the thought of his dear ones with sound which he could neither ignore nor understand, a sharp, distinct, metallic percussion like the stroke of a blacksmith's hammer upon the anvil. It had the same ringing quality. He wondered what it was, and whether immeasurably distant or nearby, it seemed both. Its recurrence was regular, but as slow as the tolling of a death knell. He awaited each new stroke with the impatience and, he knew not why, apprehension. The intervals of silence grew progressively longer. The delays became maddening. With their greater infrequency, the sounds increased in strength and sharpness. They hurt his ears like the thrust of a knife. He feared he would shriek. What he heard was the ticking of his watch. He unclosed his eyes and saw again the water below him. If I could free my hands, he thought, I might throw off the noose and spring into the stream. By diving, I could evade the bullets and, swimming vigorously, reach the bank, take to the woods, and get away home. My home, thank God, is as yet outside their lines. My wife and little ones are still beyond the invaders' farthest advance. As these thoughts, which have here to be set down in words, were flashed into the doomed man's brain rather than evolved from it, the captain nodded to the sergeant. The sergeant stepped aside. Part 2. Peyton Farquhar was a well-to-do planter of an old and highly respected Alabama family. Being a slave owner, and like other slave owners a politician, he was naturally an original secessionist and ardently devoted to the Southern cause. Circumstances of an imperious nature, which it is unnecessary to relate here, had prevented him from taking service with that gallant army which had fought the disastrous campaigns ending with the fall of Corinth, and he chafed under the inglorious restraint, longing for the release of his energies, the larger life of the soldier, the opportunity for distinction. That opportunity, he felt, would come as it comes to all in wartime. Meanwhile, he did what he could. No service was too humble for him to perform in the aid of the South, no adventure too perilous for him to undertake if consistent with the character of a civilian who was at heart a soldier, and who in good faith and without too much qualification assented to at least a part of the frankly villainous dictum that all is fair in love and war. One evening, while Farquhar and his wife were sitting on a rustic bench near the entrance to his grounds, a gray-clad soldier rode up to the gate and asked for a drink of water. Mrs. Farquhar was only too happy to serve him with her own white hands. While she was fetching the water, her husband approached the dusty horseman and inquired eagerly for news from the front. "The Yanks are repairing the railroads," said the man, "and are getting ready for another advance. They've reached the Owl Creek Bridge, put it in order, and built a stockade on the north bank. The commandant has issued an order, which is posted everywhere, declaring that any civilian caught interfering with the railroad, its bridges, tunnels, or trains will be summarily hanged. I saw the order. How far is it to the Owl Creek Bridge? Farquhar asked. About 30 miles. Is there no force on this side of the creek? Only a picket post a half mile out on the railroad, and a single sentinel at this end of the bridge. Suppose a man, a civilian and student of hanging, should elude the picket post and perhaps get the better of the sentinel, said Farquhar, smiling. What could he accomplish? The soldier reflected. I was there a month ago, he replied. I observed that the flood of last winter had lodged a great quantity of driftwood against the wooden pier at this end of the bridge. It is now dry and would burn like tinder. The lady had now brought the water, which the soldier drank. He thanked her ceremoniously, bowed to her husband, and rode away. An hour later, after nightfall, he passed the plantation, going northward, in the direction from which he'd come. He was a Federal scout. Part 3. As Peyton Farquhar fell straight downward through the bridge, he lost consciousness and was as one already dead. From this state he was awakened, ages later, it seemed to him, by the pain of a sharp pressure upon his throat, followed by a sense of suffocation. Keen, poignant agonies seemed to shoot from his neck downward through every fiber of his body and limbs. These pains appeared to flash along defined lines of ramification and to beat with an inconceivable rapid periodicity. They seemed like streams of pulsating fire, heating him to an intolerable temperature. As to his head, he was conscious of nothing but a feeling of fullness, of congestion. These sensations were unaccompanied by thought. The intellectual part of his nature was already effaced. He had power only to feel, and feeling was torment. He was conscious of motion, encompassed in a luminous cloud of which he was now merely the fiery heart, without material substance. He swung through unthinkable arcs of oscillation like a vast pendulum. Then all at once, with terrible suddenness, the light about him shot upward with the noise of a loud splash. A frightful roaring was in his ears, and all was cold and dark. The power of thought was restored. He knew that the rope had broken, and he'd fallen into the stream. There was no additional strangulation. The noose about his neck was already suffocating him and kept the water from his lungs. To die of hanging at the bottom of a river, the idea seemed to him ludicrous. He opened his eyes in the darkness and saw above him a gleam of light, but how distant and inaccessible. He was still sinking, for the light became fainter and fainter until it was a mere glimmer. Then it began to grow and brighten, and he knew that he was rising toward the surface. Knew it with reluctance, for he was now very comfortable. To be hanged and drowned, he thought, that is not so bad, but I do not wish to be shot. No, I will not be shot. That is not fair. He was not conscious of an effort, but a sharp pain in his wrist apprised him that he was trying to free his hands. He gave the struggle his attention, as an idler might observe the feat of a juggler without interest in the outcome. What splendid effort! What magnificent! What superhuman strength! Ah, that was a fine endeavor! Bravo! The cord fell away. His arms parted and floated upward, the hands dimly seen on each side of the growing light. He watched them with a new interest, as first one and then the other pounced upon the noose at his neck. They tore it away and thrust it fiercely aside, its undulations resembling those of a water snake. Put it back! Put it back! He thought he shouted these words to his hands, for the undoing of the noose had been succeeded by the direst pang that he had yet experienced. His neck ached horribly, his brain was on fire. His heart, which had been fluttering faintly, gave a great leap, trying to force itself out at his mouth. His whole body was racked and wrenched with an insupportable anguish, but his disobedient hands gave no heed to the command. They beat the water vigorously with quick downward strokes, forcing him to the surface. He felt his head emerge, his eyes were blinded by the sunlight, his chest expanded convulsively, and with a supreme and crowning agony, his lungs engulfed a great draft of air, which instantly he expelled in a shriek. He was now in full possession of his physical senses. They were indeed preternaturally keen and alert. Something in that awful disturbance of his organic system had so exalted and refined them that they made a record of things never before perceived. He felt the ripples upon his face and heard their separate sounds as they struck. He looked at the forest on the bank of the stream, saw the individual trees, the leaves and the veining of each leaf. He He saw the very insects upon them, the locusts, the brilliant-bodied flies, the gray spiders stretching their webs from twig to twig. He noted the prismatic colors in all the dewdrops upon a million blades of grass, the humming of the gnats that danced above the eddies of the stream, the beating of the dragonfly's wings, the strokes of the water spider's legs, like oars which had lifted their boat. All these made audible music. A fish slid along beneath his eyes, and he heard the rush of its body parting the water. He had come to the surface facing down the stream. In a moment, the visible world seemed to wheel slowly round, himself the pivotal point, and he saw the bridge, the fort, the soldiers upon the bridge, the captain, the sergeant, the two privates, his executioners. They were in silhouette against the blue sky. They shouted and gesticulated, pointing at him. The captain had drawn his pistol, but did not fire. The others were unarmed. Their movements were grotesque and horrible, their forms gigantic. Suddenly, he heard a sharp report, and something struck the water smartly within a few inches of his head, spattering his face with spray. He heard a second report, and saw one of the sentinels with his rifle at his shoulder, a light cloud of blue smoke rising from the muzzle. The man in the water saw the eye of the man on the bridge gazing into his own through the sights of the rifle. He observed that it was a gray eye, and remembered having read that gray eyes were keenest, and that all famous marksmen had them. Nevertheless, this one had missed. A counter-swirl had caught Farquhar and turned him half round. He was again looking at the forest on the bank opposite the fort. The sound of a clear, high voice in a monotonous sing-song now rang out behind him, and it came across the water with a distinctness that pierced and subdued all other sounds, even the beating of the ripples in his ears. Although no soldier, he had frequented camps enough to know the dread significance of that deliberate, drawling, aspirated chant the lieutenant on shore was taking a part in the morning's work. How coldly and pitilessly, with what an even, calm intonation, presaging and enforcing tranquility in the men, with what accurately measured interval fell those cruel words. Company! Attention! Shoulder arms! Ready! Aim! Fire! Farquhar dived as deeply as he could. The water roared in his ears like the voice of Niagara, yet he heard the dull thunder of the volley, and rising again towards the surface, met shining bits of metal, singularly flattened, oscillating slowly downward. Some of them touched him on the face and hands, then fell away, continuing their descent. One lodged between his collar and neck. It was uncomfortably warm, and he snatched it out. As he rose to the surface, gasping for breath, he saw that he'd been a long time underwater. He was perceptibly farther downstream, nearer to safety. The soldiers had almost finished reloading. The metal ramrods flashed all at once in the sunshine as they were drawn from the barrels, turned in the air, and thrust into their sockets. The two sentinels fired again, independently and ineffectually. The hunted man saw all this over his shoulder. He was now swimming vigorously with the current. His brain was as energetic as his arms and legs. He thought with the rapidity of lightning. The officer, he reasoned, will not make that martinet's error a second time. It is as easy to dodge a volley as a single shot. He has probably already given the command to fire at will. God help me, I cannot dodge them all. An appalling splash within 2 yards of him was followed by a loud rushing sound, which seemed to travel back through the air to the fort, and died in an explosion which stirred the very river to its deeps. A rising sheet of water curved over him, fell down upon him, blinded him, strangled him. The cannon had taken a hand in the game. As he shook his head free from the commotion of the smitten water, he heard the deflected shot humming through the air ahead, and in an instant it was cracking and smashing the branches in the forest beyond. They will not do that again, he thought. The next time they'll use a charge of grape. I must keep my eye upon the gun. The smoke will appraise me. The report arrives too late. It lags behind the missile. That is a good gun. Suddenly, he felt himself whirled round and round, spinning like a top. The water, the banks, the forests, the now distant bridge, fort and men, all were commingled and blurred. Objects were represented by their colors only, circular, horizontal streaks of color. That was all he saw. He'd been caught in a vortex, and he was being whirled on with a velocity of advance and gyration that made him giddy and sick. In a few moments he was flung upon the gravel at the foot of the left bank of the stream, the southern bank, and behind a projecting point which concealed him from his enemies. The sudden arrest of his motion, the abrasion of one of his hands on the gravel, restored him, and he wept with delight. He dug his fingers into the sand, threw it over himself in handfuls, and audibly blessed it. It looked like diamonds, rubies, emeralds. He could think of nothing beautiful which it did not resemble. The trees upon the bank were giant garden plants. He noted a definite order of their arrangement, inhaled the fragrance of their blooms. A strange roseate light shone through the spaces among their trunks, and the wind made in their branches the music of Aeolian harps. He had not wished to perfect his escape. He was content to remain in that enchanting spot until retaken. A whiz and a rattle of grape shot among the branches above his head roused him from his dream. The baffled cannoneer had fired him a random farewell. He sprang to his feet, rushed up the sloping bank, and plunged into the forest. All that day he traveled, laying his course by the rounded sun. The forest seemed interminable. Nowhere did he discover a break in it, not even a woodman's road. He had not known that he lived in so wild a region. There was something uncanny in the revelation. By nightfall he was fatigued, footsore, famished. The thought of his wife and children urged him on. At last he found a road which led him in what he knew to be the right direction. It was as wide and straight as a city street, yet it seemed untraveled. No fields bordered it, no dwelling anywhere. Not so much as the barking of a dog suggested human habitation. The black bodies of the trees formed a straight wall on both sides, terminating on the horizon in a point like a diagram in a lesson in perspective. Overhead, as he looked up through this rift in the wood, shone great golden stars looking unfamiliar and grouped in strange constellations. He was sure they were arranged in some order which had a secret and malign significance. The wood on either side was full of singular noises, among which, once, twice, and again, he distinctly heard whispers in an unknown tongue. His neck was in pain, and lifting his hand to it, he found it horribly swollen. He knew that it had a circle of black where the rope had bruised it. His eyes felt congested. He could no longer close them. His tongue was swollen with thirst. He relieved its fever by thrusting it forward from between his teeth into the cold air. How softly the turf had carpeted the untraveled avenue! He could no longer feel the roadway beneath his feet. Doubtless, despite his suffering, he had fallen asleep while walking, for now he sees another scene. Perhaps he has merely recovered from a delirium. He stands at the gate of his own home. All is as he left it, and all bright and beautiful in the morning sunshine. He must have traveled the entire night. As he pushes open the gate and passes up the wide white walk, he sees a flutter of female garments. His wife, looking fresh and cool and sweet, steps down from the veranda to meet him. At the bottom of the steps she stands waiting with a smile of ineffable joy, an attitude of matchless grace and dignity. Ah, how beautiful she is! He springs forward with extended arms. As he is about to clasp her, he feels a stunning blow upon the back of the neck. A blinding white light blazes all about him with a sound like a shock of a cannon. Then all is darkness and silence. Peyton Farquhar was dead. His body, with a broken neck, swung gently from side to side beneath the timbers of the Owl Creek Bridge. End of story.
LibriVox is an outstanding source for people who'd like to listen on their iPods or smartphones of great literature read by volunteers. Some of their recordings are a little bit primitive. I had to check with the volume slide on that. I must apologize if it blasted your earbuds. We'll finish off in the download zone with Naomi Fowler's outstanding Tax Justice Network. Now, if you just Google or search, do a Zen search, and look for Tax Justice Network, an international congregation of people, research economists, and people who just do their homework on tax shelf, tax havens where the rich take their money and hide it. In a similar vein, I would strongly recommend checking out Sam Pizzagatti's outstanding free weekly newsletter called Too Much Online. Fellow conservatives, progressives, we must do our homework and tell people the facts. Here's Naomi. I'll be back on tomorrow at noon with Secular Sunday. I am happy to announce, not this Secular Sunday, but next we're going to have the famous writer, painter, and humorist, Francis Schaeffer, Jr., talking about his latest book, Why I Am an Atheist and Believe in God. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Thank you so much for listening to Radio Free Kansas on the weekend. Tomorrow, we'll have great book interviews from the new book networks, as well as I will try to make some more announcements, calendar announcements. I fail miserably because I get so enchanted with giving you these gems that I discover on the World Wide Net, as long as we have it.
Bye. Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal, and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The TaxCast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhaven.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Coming up later, forget Congress. We'll be looking at the latest U.S. state to legislate against tax havens. Stay tuned for that. Here's a quick Tax Justice News Roundup for this month. Let's kick off with some good news for a change. A Tax Justice Network affiliate in Colombia, Justicia Tributaria, has managed to suspend the sale of a publicly owned majority stake in the power company Isagen. The authorities there are looking into complaints that the sale violates the Constitution and will be of little or no benefit to Colombians. There are plenty of bad experiences in other countries of this phenomenon of public-to-private asset stripping. When utility companies are moved into the private sector, a nation tends to lose not only that as an asset, but also huge amounts of tax revenue through high levels of debt and the offshoring of profit. Now the Colombian government will have to justify why the sale of this profitable company is in the public interest. We'll be following what happens on the TaxCast. A group of responsible investors are challenging Google on its tax affairs at its annual shareholder meeting. Their proposals on the agenda calling for the company's board to, quote, adopt a set of principles to address the impact of Google's tax strategies on society, with particular focus on Google's employees, customers, and suppliers, close quote. I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that meeting. As we know on the TaxCast, corrupt officials and criminals just love Swiss secrecy laws. And it turns out that Norway's sovereign wealth funds are a significant shareholder of Swiss banks UBS and Credit Suisse, both investigated over accusations of concealment of assets, money laundering, abetting tax evasion and tax fraud. Norway apparently even owns the headquarters of Credit Suisse in Zurich. Yet Norway's also a champion of transparency and social justice. Member of the European Parliament, Ana Gomes, has written to them to point out the hypocrisy of their position. And on this month's Roll of Dishonour, there was a public grilling this month at the US's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations for the company Caterpillar. They wanted to know more about their use of a Swiss affiliate to avoid $2.4 billion in taxes. Switzerland offered them a 4-6% corporate tax rate. And who set that up for them? PricewaterhouseCoopers. And they charged Caterpillar $55 million. Here's a question for you. How long does it take to release a report? Well, it depends if you want to sit on it. And that seems to be what the European Investment Bank wants to do. The bank's owned by EU member states, and years ago it lent $50 million to Mopani Copper Mines, which is mainly owned by the Swiss Glencore Xstrata. It then turned out Mopani avoided paying tens of millions of dollars in tax to the Zambian government, which is already overly generous when it comes to taxing foreign mining companies. The European Central Bank announced an investigation, but 3 years later, we're none the wiser about its findings. And how long do you think it takes them to answer a letter? The bank still hasn't responded to a formal complaint made by Christian Aid 9 months later. And finally, instead of serving a one-year prison sentence for tax fraud behind bars, billionaire and former Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi will do community service, caring for the elderly 4 hours a week. Those are the Tax Justice headlines for this month. Now we're going to talk to Director of the Tax Justice Network, John Christensen, for his take on events this month. Okay, John, don't know if we can possibly do this justice in a few minutes, but there's been some new research on the amount of money held offshore by the very, very wealthy. Tell us about that.
Gabriel Zucman's new paper coming out of the Paris School of Economics reveals yet again that astonishing levels of wealth concentrating in the hands of a tiny, tiny minority. The Occupy movement talked about the 1%, but Gabriel Zucman talks about the 0.1%. Zucman also confirms what many of us already know, which is that a huge proportion of this wealth is held in offshore tax havens. Well, what's new here, you may ask? What's new is that Zucman's analysis confirms that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and other organizations have been producing analysis of wealth and the global economy which are astonishingly weak, almost to the point of being absurd. And their numbers simply don't add up. And what this suggests is that a very large proportion of assets are held offshore outside the statistical databases of the international financial institutions. This raises important questions. As far as civil society is concerned, I think there's a scandal in the fact that some of this data is being collected, for example, by the Bank for International Settlements, but the Bank for International Settlements quite simply won't allow us access to that data, saying it's private data. It does seem to me that the Bank for International Settlements is guilty of withholding data, partly in order to downplay the importance of the offshore issue.
Right, so that's why the figures don't add up, because there isn't access to the full figures on offshore private wealth.
Well, I, for example, and people I know, have asked for access to the Bank for International Settlements data on many occasions. I asked for it about 15 years ago and was very politely refused because I was told that this information, although it is collected, is not made public. Gabriel Zucman and his colleague Neil Johansson at the Copenhagen Business School have been allowed access to some of this data at least, which raises questions. Why do they get access and why haven't we? But, you know, that's not really the issue. The real issue is that this information has not been made public, but has not been made use of by the International Monetary Fund and other organizations, which means that a huge issue around wealth concentrations and the way that wealth has been shifted offshore has simply been kept off the agenda by the international financial institutions. One has to ask, whose interests have they been protecting?
Let's talk about Lord Blencathra. This month, his lobbying contract with the Cayman Islands has been terminated. Lord Blencathra, he's a former government minister, so he's pretty high up in the now ruling Conservative Party in the British government. Also a peer, which means he sits in the second House of Parliament, appointed, not elected. Anyway, Lord Blencathra insists he never fulfilled the lobbying part of his contract. £12,000 a month they were paying him.
Lord Blencathra, who some of those with long memories will know of as David McLean, has previously been implicated in corruption rows. He was implicated in an expenses row. He claimed £20,000 for improvements to his farmhouse, which was his main residence. Also, at one stage, he was trying to lobby to exempt both Houses of Parliament from the Freedom of Information Act. So this is clearly not a man who's a great believer in democracy or accountability. Now, once his role had been revealed by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, Lancaster's usefulness to the Kamanians was clearly compromised, and they quickly cut the contract.
Right, because paid advocacy is against the rules.
What this story reveals, yet again, is that some UK parliamentarians, and sadly it's quite a number of them, still haven't learned the lessons from past scandals, and they refuse to recognise that there's a deep conflict of interest between being a guardian of public interest on the one hand and being a lobbyist for private interests on the other. What's particularly bad in this case, of course, is that Lancaster was acting as a lobbyist for a world-famous and notorious tax haven.
Yeah, I mean, what's a chap to do with that $12,000 a month? And he did assist in events trying to persuade UK companies to move jobs and taxable income, presumably, from the UK to the Cayman Islands.
Undermining UK interests. Shame on the UK Parliament for continuing to allow people, lobbyists like this, to operate from within their ranks.
Okay, and very quickly, we can stay in Britain just for a minute. The UK Chancellor's announced that it's really going to crack down on tax cheats. They're going to toughen up the law, not to tackle the corporate avoidance, that's such a big problem for the UK, but tackling individuals. But it's actually already an offence to submit a false tax return, isn't it? So am I being a bit too cynical by pointing out this big announcement was made while the Chancellor was at an IMF meeting in Washington, trying to impress their friends and look like a really active G20 member?
Yes, Her Majesty's government now plans to create a criminal offence in respect of failing to declare offshore income. This has been spun as part of the government's attempts to crack down on rampant tax evasion by individuals. Whilst, of course, we welcome any move that will deter people from using offshore accounts to evade tax in this country and any other country, some people might think there's something illegal about holding an offshore account. There isn't. The illegality lies in not declaring any incomes arising from that. But under the existing laws, it is already illegal to not declare on your tax returns that you're receiving income or capital gains from an offshore account. So what's changed? As soon as you sign a tax declaration in this country and in most other countries, saying that that declaration is a truthful statement, but you failed to declare that you're receiving income from an offshore account, you have engaged in a criminal offence. Is this a major new reform? Probably not.
Right, so quite a lot of spin going on there. Let's go and have a look at Nigeria now. We've had big news this month. It's doubled its GDP in one day. That's by including big industries like film and mobile phones in the statistics and the economic figures. It makes it the biggest economy in Africa, which makes little difference to ordinary Nigerians, I guess, except that it seems that Nigeria isn't taxing very much at all, which does affect people there. And that is, Nigeria is one of the only countries in the world now where more than 1 in 10 children die before their 5th birthday.
Right, this is at one level an extraordinary story of economic success and economic failure. This month they've revised the basis of their calculations of gross domestic product. GDP calculations of national income are widely used as a demonstration of economic growth. This is the first time that they've recalculated their GDP base in close to a quarter of a century. And so they announced earlier this month that their 2013 GDP estimates had increased by a whopping 90%. Now, the sad truth is, of course, that most Nigerians live on less than $1 a day, which is shocking. But the revised national income data shows that Nigeria has a far stronger economy than was previously being recorded. But this raises some really important questions about tax policies and tax governance in Nigeria. To begin with, the 2013 tax revenues are relatively healthy by African standards, 20% of gross domestic product, which is above the regional average. But, and this is the bad news, about two-thirds of the total tax revenues come from oil and gas. The non-oil and gas revenues hover around 6-7% of total GDP, which is worryingly low, even by African standards, and suggests shockingly weak effort by politicians to collect tax fairly and to redistribute wealth and income. Now, all of this, of course, is reflected in a very low level of public expenditure in Nigeria in education, in training, in health, infrastructure, and security. And UNICEF, United Nations body, shows that Nigeria is one of the few countries in the world that has actually seen a deterioration in the last few years, since 2007.
Right, and they're also receiving nearly $2 billion a year in aid, I think, whilst they're not taxing some of the businesses there, I guess.
And we've argued for a very long time, now is the time to shift away from pumping aid into countries like Nigeria, which is not acting effectively, and putting much more focus on Nigerian politicians to raise revenues in a fair and equitable sort of way, and to use the tax revenues effectively to invest in Nigeria's long-term future.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. TaxCast listeners know there's been a whole lot of fine talk from governments, the G20, OECD member countries, about tackling corporate use of tax havens. But, well, talk is cheap. This month, the TaxCast looks at some plucky states in the US who got tired of waiting for the national government to act and did it for themselves. We're in the US state of Maine this month, known as the Pine Tree State. Around 83% of it's forest. It has beautiful mountains and a long rocky coastline. With a population of 1.3 million, it's one of the smaller US states. It's also the latest state to say no to multinational corporations using tax havens to avoid taxes. Here's the sponsor of Maine's bill to reclaim that tax revenue, Representative Adam Good.
Our state loses $10 million for each two-year budget based on these accounting tricks by multinational corporations. $10 million is a lot of money. That's how much money we lose each biennial budget by continuing to let multinational corporations hide their income in offshore tax havens. It creates an unlevel playing field, and small businesses in Maine don't use these tricks, and they're stuck at a competitive disadvantage.
And he knows he must be onto something good when the state of Maine starts getting letters from ambassadors in Liechtenstein and Luxembourg telling them this bill's a really bad idea. Of course, they're not tax havens, they say. They're just giving helpful advice to one of the US's smaller states on the other side of the world about how they should vote on tax reform. Adam Good again.
You know, legislators get lobbied all the time by powerful interests, and it, you know, kind of boggles my mind why we would be prioritizing Liechtenstein or Luxembourg over taxpayers in Maine. Nike isn't going to stop selling shoes in Maine, and Apple isn't going to stop selling iPods in Maine because they have to declare their corporate income even if they're hiding it in Liechtenstein or Luxembourg.
Now, common sense tells you, doesn't it, that if a...
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.